Hello and welcome to another episode of my podcast. I think we're probably going to go with Steeped in History, so welcome to another episode of Steeped in History. It's me, it's Jimmy, and today we are going to be doing the same thing that we are going to be doing in every episode, but it's me solo again today, and today we're going to be talking about what book I'm reading, what kind of tea I'm drinking right now, and we're going to discuss a period in history that I find fascinating that is related to today. So let's crack on. So segment one is the tea that I'm drinking, and today I am drinking Yorkshire Gold tea, which is a very nice drop of tea. If you've not had Yorkshire Gold, I highly recommend it. I know that Yorkshire tea is available in the US and Canada now. I don't know if Yorkshire tea is available, if Yorkshire Gold is available, but Yorkshire Gold is sort of there. Premium blend, and it's as much of a premium blend as you can get from a sort of mass-produced factory tea bag tea. Their loose leaf is obviously superior. I'm using tea bags right now, much to my shame. I know I should be using loose leaf. I apologize to all of my tea aficionados who are listening, but right now I'm using tea bags. It's been a hectic month. I drink it the same as I drink all of my black teas. I have it with a little splash of milk, quite strongly brewed, because that's just how I like to drink my tea. As ever, no judgment if you have yours weak with three sugars, if you have it black with lemon. You do you. I'm not here to judge you, but I will think that your tastes are absolutely abhorrent. So, tea out of the way, Yorkshire Gold, well brewed, quite strong, splash of milk in a nice mug, a plain mug kind of a guy. Don't have any really fancy tea mugs. I like a straight-sided mug with a big handle. Let's move on to books. So the book that I'm reading at the moment is a very different tone to the book I was reading last time, which was The History of the Opium Wars, which is a very heavy, quite academic history book of a really tragic and really turbulent period. This time I am reading I am reading Marie Hartley and Joan Ingleby's The Old Knitters of the Dales, which is a book that was originally printed in 1951, and the edition I'm reading is from 1988, and it's an absolute cracker of a book. This is borrowed from my local library, and it has the sheet in the front with all of the times that it's been lent out, going back to 1991, I think I can see here, 22nd of November 1991, and up till 2011 it was still being written on the front sheet, the little ticket in the front, and so I have put 2025 onto the sheet so that people know that it's been taken out, because I know it's all going to be recorded digitally, but I think it's fun to have it recorded in pen in the sheet at the front of the book as well. I just think that's a cool thing. It's a neat thing. So this book is, like I say, extremely different in tone, and it's actually not what I thought it was going to be. It is a fairly serious work. It's the only book that they've written about knitting, and it describes itself on the back as, here in great detail is the story of the hand-knitting industry, which was a factor in keeping up the population of remote Pennine Dales for three centuries. Which it absolutely is. It's a very good in-depth history of the industry, but I was hoping that it might have some more details in the actual techniques being used by the knitters, and there are some mentions of things like swathing, which is a form of speed knitting where, if you think of somebody using a loom, somebody using a hand loom, they kind of rock backwards and forwards with the rhythm of the cloth that's being woven on it. If they're going at speed, if that's their work, their job, there's a lot of movement, there's a lot of shoulders moving forward and back. Swathing is something similar where you kind of use the arms moving forward and backwards in a sort of one and two and one and two and rhythm as you're knitting to make your knitting go faster. And it kind of helps you to get into the rhythm of just chucking lots and lots of, if you've got absolutely tons of plain knit to get through, as they did if they were knitting a pair of men's stockings, for example, because that's what, you know, that's like 20 odd inches of stocking, maybe more if they're sea boots, you have to do that in a day, and there are lots of accounts of people knitting stockings in a day in the 18th and 19th centuries. You have to be able to do that quickly and rhythmically, and the rhythm helps. And there were songs that were sung, just like walking songs and carding songs, and various other crafting songs to help the rhythm. So there's mention of swathing, and there's mention of the use of bent wire needles. So needles that were simply wire bought and cut to the right length and sharpened, sometimes on a hearthstone, which were then used as knitting needles. And I really like the idea of that. It also mentions the use of knitting sheaths, which I already knew about, and knitting sheaths are a fascinating craft subject in their own right. They're basically carved pieces of wood that you tuck into your waist belt or into your apron string, and you insert your right-hand needle into the sheath, and the sheath then takes the weight of the work and allows your right hand to just work with the working yarn instead of also supporting the weight of your work and a knitting needle. So it's all techniques used to maximize the efficiency of somebody who's doing this as their job. And it is a fascinating book. It's quite dry. There are a lot of facts and figures. There are lots of letters from the 18th and 19th century from people talking about ordering wool and the problem of using new technology and the amount of money that's being spent and made on purchasing wool and selling stockings at markets, which is all really interesting social history and economic history. But I want to get better at knitting, which is one of the reasons I got this book. I've been having some trouble with tendonitis in my right arm, and I thought a knitting sheath might help, so I was hoping to find some information on the techniques being used. There are people who speed knit today who can go at incredible speeds, but I'm not sure if they go quite as fast as some of the older knitters in this book are claiming, who claim to be able to do 400 stitches a minute. 200. They claim to be able to do 200 stitches a minute. 400, I think, would be physically impossible, but 200 is still crazy. That's still, what, maybe 4 a second? So you're like, bam, 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 bam. That's, I can't imagine knitting that quickly. That's machine knitting. But I would like to be able to knit a little bit quicker, maybe a little bit more efficiently, and without straining my tendons quite so much. So I'm hoping that some of the information here will help. I plan to make my own knitting sheath, so I'll keep you updated either here or on the YouTube channel or on my socials or a combination of all three on how all that goes. But yeah, The Old Hand Knitters of the Dales by Marie Hartley and Joan Ingleby is quite interesting. And it draws parallels between the town of Bala in North Wales. Bala is a place that was famous for the stocking industry, stocking knitting as well. And the women of Bala, especially the women, claimed to be able to knit a man's stocking in a day. The men would also knit, as would children of all genders. And in fact, poor children were taught to knit in the 19th and early 20th centuries. Girls and boys were taught to knit at school. Not necessarily specialist schools, although there were knitting schools that were established. In fact, we have a knitting school in York in 1590 that was established to teach children in St. Saviour's Parish how to knit rapidly so that they could contribute to the economy, because knitting was basically what poor people did to make money if they didn't have any other work on. So if you were driving cattle or sheep and you didn't need your hands, you would be knitting whilst you were walking alongside the livestock. If you're going to get shopping or supplies and you have your basket on your head or slung over your arm, you would be knitting whilst you were walking so that you could produce stockings that a hosier could then take to market and sell so that you could make some extra money, because you had to. That was the handcraft that paid. When I say stockings, I mean socks. So everyday socks, not like, you know, ooh, sexy fishnets. I mean everyday stockings, everyday knitwear for your feet and lower legs, because they are essential for everybody who has to do any walking for any length of time. And in particular, they were very useful for the armed forces in the 18th and 19th centuries. A lot of these stockings were destined for the army. So, that is the book I've been reading. I wasn't expecting to spend almost 10 minutes talking about The Old Hand Knitters of the Dales, but it is a fascinating read. If you can get a hold of it, it's well worth a read. It's really interesting if you're a crafter, if you're a social historian, if you're an economic historian, looking into pre-industrial and actually industrial cottage industries is a really interesting subject.
whether or not you're a knitter, but if you are a knitter, it's a fascinating read, so I highly recommend it if you can get hold of it. I think both of the authors, have passed away, and I don't think the book is in print anymore. This was published by the Dalesman publishing company based in Lancaster, so I don't even know if that company is going anymore. But if you can find a copy of The Old Hand Knitters of the Dales by Marie Hartley and Joan Ingleby, it's a great little read, and it's got lots of interviews with old people, which is always great fun to read about. So there you go, a little treat from the 1950s. So we're going to move on to the next section, which is talking about a place and a period. And my original idea for this was that we would talk about a year and a location. And that would be our next segment, whether it's just me or it's me with a guest. But today, we're going to do something slightly different. I know, changing the format so early. I know. How wild am I? And today we're going to be talking about a day of the month and 2 years. We are going to be talking about January the 30th. Now, January the 30th is a date on which lots and lots and lots of things have happened. Over the years, lots of things have happened on this particular day in lots of different places. But we are going to be talking about January the 30th, 1649, and January the 30th, 1661. So two Januaries the 30th, both of them linked. And the first January the 30th in 1649 is the date of the execution of Charles the First. So Charles the First, as many of you will already know, was King of England and Wales and Scotland, and also Ireland, from different times actually. He was King of England and Wales and Ireland from he was crowned King of Scotland in 1633. He was crowned King of England and Wales and Ireland in 1626, I beg your pardon. But he was executed in 1649. Yes, the king was executed, famously executed after the English Civil War in 1642. Effectively, Charles raised an army, and Parliament raised an army by volunteers, after he had basically attempted to arrest members of Parliament in Parliament, and that was Pym, Hampden, Holles, Strode, and what was the other one called? Hazelrig, and he also tried to arrest Lord Mandeville for treason, and Parliament refused to hand them over, and he had to leave, and it was a disaster. It was a political disaster for him. No English monarch had entered the House of Commons in that way before. He invaded the House of Commons and tried to arrest members of Parliament, which was a breach of parliamentary privilege, and his supporters had been trying to show him as this bastion of defence against new political order that was causing chaos and all of this republican murmuring that had been happening, and him invading Parliament completely shot that to bits. So he completely screwed the pooch. And all of this is in January of 1642. So he's only got 7 years left to live when this happens. And by the end of 1642, in October, the Battle of Edge Hill happened, so a proper pitched battle of the English Civil Wars. Charles is then given, effectively, to Parliament as a hostage in 1647. And the Scots give Charles to Parliament for £100,000, basically, which is an amazing sentence to be able to say about a king. Like, the Scots gave the King of England and Scotland to Parliament for £100,000. And he was arrested. He was taken and put into house arrest, first in Nottinghamshire, and then he was taken to Hampton Court. And he escaped from Hampton Court Palace, and he managed to get to Carisbrook Castle. He escaped from Hampton Court Palace, got to the Isle of Wight, where he was found and he was kept in the castle. He tried his best to get away, he tried his best to escape, he signed a secret treaty with the Scots, where the Scots said that they would invade England on behalf of King Charles and restore him to the throne, on the condition that they could establish Presbyterianism in England. So, at the time, Presbyterianism was the Protestant religion in Scotland. Of course, in England, it was the Church of England. And the Scots said, okay, we will invade England for you and put you back on the throne. But Presbyterianism has to be established for 3 years. You have to let us establish this type of religion. And it was the Scottish Presbyterians who had captured him in the first place at Newark. Or rather, he was he surrendered himself to the Scottish Presbyterians in 1647, really. Let's re-record this bit. So by 1647, things aren't going very well. There is a Scottish Presbyterian army besieging Newark. Charles puts himself into their care. He surrenders himself to the Scottish Presbyterians, basically. He's taken up to Newcastle upon Tyne, and after nearly a year, in January 1647, he is exchanged to Parliament, to the English Parliament, for £100,000 and a promise that they'll get even more money. So that's it. Charles has been captured. He is under house arrest. He's taken to Hampton Court Palace, which is a pretty nice place to be put under house arrest. I'm going to tell you that. I've been there. It's a pretty sweet deal. But he flees in November, November the 11th, 1647, thinking maybe he'll go to France, maybe he'll go to Berwick-upon-Tweed, to the Scottish border, and he flees and gets to the Isle of Wight. So he gets to the Isle of Wight off the south coast of Britain, where he is confined in a place called Carisbrook Castle, which is still there, which is a pretty nice house on the Isle of Wight. It's more of a fortified house now, but it is a Mott and Bailey castle. It's a proper Norman castle. He is then trying his best in the Isle of Wight to negotiate with people. At one point, he signs a treaty with the Scots, with Presbyterian Scots, which basically says that the Scots agree to invade England and put Charles back on the throne, restore him, if Presbyterianism is allowed to establish for 3 years in England. So the Presbyterians in Scotland are like, yeah, of course, we'll help you get your throne back if you let us spread our Christian denomination in England. And he agrees it. He signs it. Day after Christmas, Boxing Day 1647, he signs this. But the next year, the Second Civil War starts in May, in my birth month in 1648. The Royalists rise up again, and the Scots invade. There are uprisings all over the place, but by that point, the Scots are defeated in Preston in the summer, and there's no chance that the Royalists are going to win. So Charles returns to negotiations on the Isle of Wight, again, a lovely place to hold negotiations, and Oliver Cromwell basically says, right, we've had enough of this. No more negotiations. No more talking with the king. None of this is happening. We're going to arrest people who supported the king. We're going to arrest any members of Parliament who are against what we're doing here. It's basically a military coup under Oliver Cromwell, takes control of Parliament. Charles is put on trial at the start of 1649. He's put on trial for treason. He's indicted for treason, which is rejected by the House of Lords, but still, the monarch, the ruling king, is indicted for treason by the House of Commons. And effectively, the High Court puts him on trial, is accused of treason, and he is found guilty and has his head cut off. So, after 3 days and 30 witnesses, he's condemned to death. he comes in front of a public session, he's declared guilty, he's sentenced, and the judgment says, "For all which treasons and crimes this court doth adjudge that he, the said Charles Stuart, as a tyrant, traitor, murderer, and public enemy to the good people of this nation, shall be put to death by the severing of his head from his body." Which is an incredible thing to hear somebody say. That's an amazing statement. So, it's scheduled for Tuesday, the 30th of January, 1649. He has two kids who are allowed to visit him the day before, and the next morning he is famously asks for two shirts. So he puts on two shirts because it's cold and he doesn't want to shiver in front of the crowd and have them think that it's fear. And there's a quote from him, which is taken from the official website of the monarchy, which is royal.gov.uk, and the quote is, "The season is so sharp as probably may make me shake, which some observers may imagine proceeds from fear. I would have no such imputation." He goes to St. James's Palace, which is a very nice palace. I think, the oldest royal palace in London, and it's absolutely beautiful. It's a lovely, lovely building. It's got a lovely brick tower with a clock that you approach at the front of the palace. It's absolutely beautiful. And the scaffold was erected at Whitehall, which is where the Houses of Parliament are. There were loads of soldiers between him and the crowd. The crowd was massive. He was so far away from the crowd that hardly anybody could actually hear it. And his speech has been written down. We have his speech. I know I'm giving you lots of speeches, but it's really interesting. He says, "An unjust sentence that I suffered to take effect is punished now by an unjust sentence on me." And at 2 o'clock, he says a prayer, puts his head on the block, and signals that he's ready by stretching his hands out. And he was beheaded in one clean stroke. And a witness said that a moan as I never heard before and desire I may never hear again rose from the crowd. People were dipping their blood in his handkerchief as a memento. People were crying. The executioner had to be disguised. Nobody's sure who did it to this day. We're not sure. We know that whoever did it was probably paid a great deal of money, but there are at least three different options for who cut Charles I's head off. Nobody knows. It was kept secret for 400 years. And his body was taken to Windsor, and it was actually examined in 1813, which is how we know that one clean strike did it, because it was examined. And clearly that was done by an experienced executioner, so somebody who knew what they were doing cut off Charles I's head. And generally, if somebody is convicted of treason and beheaded, they hold up the head and say, "Behold, the head of a traitor," but they didn't do that with Charles. They exhibited it, they held it up so that people could see that it had been done, but they didn't call him a traitor afterwards, and his head was sewn back on his body, which didn't normally happen at all. So, Charles I, executed at 2 o'clock on January the 30th, 1649. There was a plan for a big mausoleum in Hyde Park, but that never actually happened. That was never done. The second date, January the 30th, 1661, is the ritual execution of Oliver Cromwell. That's right, the man who basically led the coup that had Charles executed. And he died, Oliver Cromwell, in 1658, 3 years before his head was cut off. He was given a big public funeral in Westminster Abbey, and his son Richard did a terrible job and was overthrown by King Charles II. Charles I's son came back from exile, and in January 1661, he orders that Oliver Cromwell's body is dug up from Westminster Abbey with two other people, and that they be executed for treason at Tyburn, which is in London. It's actually on the corner of Hyde Park. If you go to London now, there's nothing much there. There's a little sign, and it says, this was Tyburn, basically. but hundreds if not thousands of people have been hanged at Tyburn. And the bodies of Henry Ireton, John Bradshaw, and Oliver Cromwell were dug up, they were taken to Tyburn, and they were left hanging from morning until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The original order said that they should be hung up in their coffins. I'm not sure if that was the case, but the original Parliament order from Parliament said they are to be hung up in their coffins. And they were then cut down and they were beheaded. And the heads were put on 20-foot poles. Basically, they were put on pikes on Westminster Hall, which was where the trial of Charles I had happened 12 years before. So Oliver Cromwell's head was stuck up on a pike in the place where Charles I's trial, the three-day trial, had happened. So his head was there for at least 23 years, at least 1684. From 1684 to 1710, we don't know where it went. There is a tradition that says it was blown off on a stormy night, and one of the guards picked it up and took it home. But it was in private collectors for a very long time, until 1960, when it was buried in Cambridge at Sidney Sussex College, the University of Cambridge, which is where Oliver Cromwell went to university. That was his alma mater. Not exactly sure where it's buried. It's buried in a kind of an anonymous, unmarked location somewhere in the grounds of Sidney Sussex College. But his head was chopped off 12 years later using what's called a writ of attainder, or a writ of attainter, or a bill of attainder. And that basically means that somebody can be declared a traitor. You can say that somebody is a traitor without trial. It effectively is a bill that passes through Parliament, and if it's passed, then the person who is named in the bill of attainder is declared a traitor and can immediately basically be convicted without trial. And that's what happened to Catherine Howard, Henry VIII's wife. She was convicted using a bill of attainder. She was declared a traitor using a parliamentary bill, and that allowed her to be executed. So that's what happened to Oliver Cromwell and also Henry Ireton and John Bradshaw. They were declared traitors, posthumously declared traitors, because of course they couldn't sit trial. You can't have a dead person in a trial. Well, it has been done by the Roman Catholic Church. They have dug people up and interrogated them in the medieval period. But Oliver Cromwell, 12 years later, on this day, I'm recording this on January the 30th, and I thought, hang on, this is when Charles I was executed, and this is also when Oliver Cromwell's body was executed. So I thought I would do this weird 17th century, 12 years apart, twin execution. Although, if they kept the bodies at Tyburn hanging until 4 p.m, technically that means that they were 2 hours late for the anniversary of the execution. Tut tut, shame on you, Charles II. But there we go. I hope that was fun for you. That was certainly fun for me. I'm going to finish my Yorkshire Gold, and I'm going to finish my old hand knitters of the Dales and take it back to the library so somebody else can enjoy it. Maybe you'll be the next person to take it out. If you are, that would be really fun. But I hope you've enjoyed this little episode of Steeped in History. Diolch yn fawr iawn am wrando. Thank you very much for listening. And until the next time, tan y tro nesa, as ever, hwyl fawr am y tro. Bye-bye for now. Steeped in History was produced by Jimmy Johnson. It was presented by Jimmy Johnson. It was researched by Jimmy Johnson. Basically, I did all of this. But it does also feature music by Inaban.